The United Nations estimates that up to 80% of North Koreans experience hunger. The UN also believes that up to 120,000 political prisoners are held in a Soviet-style gulag system. Almost no North Koreans are allowed to travel out of the country, and almost no foreigners are allowed in. That's why it's hard to verify information about what's considered one of the most oppressive regimes in the world. But my guest in this hour, journalist Suki Kim, has been there. She landed a job as an English teacher at an all-male university near Pyongyang and secretly kept notes about her experiences. A rare glimpse of life inside North Korea with Suki Kim on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here, our second hour. Thanks again for joining us. Never wear blue jeans. Never approach anyone you don't know to start a conversation. Be constantly on guard about what you write in emails. Don't take pictures. And never, ever get caught criticizing the government of North Korea or its great leader. These were just a few of the items on Suki Kim's list of don'ts that helped get her through a six-month stint as a teacher at Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, and that was in 2011. Suki Kim is my guest in this hour of Midday. Her memoir, Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite, offers a rare glimpse inside one of the world's strangest and most oppressive regimes. Suki Kim has traveled to North Korea as a journalist. She got the job as a teacher there by posing sort of as a missionary. We'll hear about that during this hour of the show. She spent her formative years in South Korea before her family moved to the United States when she was a teenager. And her parents both lost relatives to North Korea abductions around the time of the Korean War. Suki Kim is an excellent writer. She's written for the New York Times and Harper's and the New York Review of Books. She's also a novelist, as well as a nonfiction writer, and a Guggenheim and Fulbright Fellow. Again, this book is Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite, one of the bestsellers on the New York Times bestseller list. And Suki Kim is in Baltimore to speak tonight at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We'll tell you about that as well. So, Suki Kim, nice to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. I'm curious about your family's connection to North Korea. I thought we'd start there. You grew up in South Korea, but your family had relatives in the North.
Actually, no, we're all from South Korea, but during the Korean War, my mother's brother and my father's cousins were all taken to North Korea.
That's the abductions I referenced.
Yeah, I think a lot of families, actually, you know, they're not a minority. This happened to, the estimate is something like a million plus families during the war were separated. And so, you know, basically they never saw their family again.
Hmm.
So that's the connection that I had personally. I grew up, you know, watching my grandmother just mourning her son, waiting for him to come home because there was no border before the war. And suddenly there was this border, which everybody thought was going to open like next week. And 60 years passed. So until the day she died, she basically waited for him to come home.
That was your uncle that you never knew. He was a teenager when the war happened.
He was 17. And when the war happened, she basically lost him during the wartime. And everyone saw him being taken by North Korean soldiers. I mean, this is a common story in Korean families.
That's what I was going to ask you. So when I say that there are people in the South who have relatives in the North, that may be true then.
Oh, many do. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes also people, it's a very, very small country. It's the size of Pennsylvania. It's a very small country. So you basically, you know, suddenly you might have an aunt over there or your father was on a business trip in the next town and the border came down. And because it's not a tribal system, you know, they basically, it's kind of like from Baltimore to D.C. and wall came down and then that's it.
When you were growing up in South Korea and then moved to the United States, where was North Korea in your mind as a young girl? What did you hear about it from, besides your grandmother? What did you hear about it from people? What was its presence in your mind?
I think there were two things, which is, you know, I grew up in 1970s South Korea, which was a time of dictatorship. And there was definitely, you know, an anti-communism sort of a propaganda from South Korea's angle. But apart from that, which is really, you know, the government's portrayal of what North Korea might be, it's a divided nation. But I think I just kind of thought of it as a heartbreak, because personally, I just grew up hearing the story of my grandmother missing her son. To me, it was just a human story. How do you lose your son one day and he's just around the corner and you can't get to him? He can't get to you. And then she died. Because you would think basically that separation should be solved. But, you know, separation is different from death. It's a forced separation, has a heartbreak that is kind of a different kind. And I kind of thought of Korean nation, the Korean War, the division of Korea as a human tragedy that affected million plus families.
You say in the book, separation haunts the affected long after the actual incident. It is a perpetual act of violation.
Yes, because I think it makes you helpless.
So when you get a little bit older and you're starting to work as a journalist, you get to make a trip to North Korea. It was the first trip, 2002, am I right?
2002, I went to Pyongyang for the celebration of the 60th birthday celebration of Kim Jong-il, who was then the great leader. And that was sort of a chance. And, you know, I got to see North Korea in a different, you know, it's the first time there. And I was very struck by the entire experience. I ended up writing a piece for the New York Review of Books after that time. And I think I myself am an immigrant, first generation. I came at the age of 13. I didn't speak a word of English because I was a child. I didn't choose to come here. So I think the separation, you know, forever haunted me on a personal level for myself as well.
Did you have any trouble getting in the country in 2002 for that assignment?
I joined a pro-North organization in order to enter that time. So I didn't really know, though, what I was getting into. I think it would be incorrect for me to claim now that that was some sort of an undercover thing. All I knew at the time was I needed to see it. Mm-hmm. I was curious, and that was the way to get in.
Were there any conditions on you as a journalist working there? Did you have to show them stories you were going to write?
Actually, when I did go in, I didn't know if I would write about this. So I didn't actually tell anyone, but it's not because I literally actually myself didn't know if I had a story. So I was just going with a flow that time. And the organization that invited me, 2002, did not tell me that they were actually had secretly chosen me as a youth delegate for the mission. Mission meaning great leader celebration mission.
Right.
And so when I arrived in Pyongyang, I was billed as, you know, these basically all these people ran to me calling out the youth representative, welcome, and television screen. And so they had chosen me specifically as a youth delegate there to honor the grand leader. So it was a very bizarre experience. I stayed at a VIP quarter.
Oh, nice. But what was expected of you? Did you have to give a speech or something?
I had to go to a lot of these big meetings, you know, celebration meetings, thousands of these, I guess, workers' party members and stuff. And I had to just sort of sit there as a representative from the United States of a pro-North Korean organization. But, you know, none of that was related to me until I arrived. So it was really a surprising, kind of a scary, obviously, because I didn't know anything about it. And I just also had to do a lot of Juche lessons on Juche is North Korea's foundation philosophy, meaning self-reliance. So they gave me lessons on Juche, and I had to do karaoke with the leaders, the Workers' Party leaders. So that was...
That might have been the most torturous part of it. Or did you like karaoke?
Karaoke, I like it back in my life in New York, but in North Korea with the Workers' Party leaders, actually the problem, and I ended up writing about all of this in the New York Review Books piece, was I didn't know what song to choose. because you know, you can't really do you know, American rock and roll.
I was gonna say, you probably weren't doing any Britney Spears karaoke at the time.
Exactly.
So what did you do? Some nationalist song of North Korea?
Which I don't know, so I didn't. I couldn't choose that, and it would have been very disingenuous to suddenly pick a song I've never heard of. And South Korean songs are banned there. So, but somebody then told me choose this song called "Morning Dew," which was a protest against dictatorship in South Korea. One of those folk songs that were used anti-government in South Korea. So it was a political song in South Korea. And someone told me to sing that. And I thought it was very interesting. That was the only song allowed in North Korea from South Korea.
Wow. Can you describe the atmosphere in Pyongyang the first time you were there? Describe that for us.
It was very dire. You know, I think that ended up being an important context for me to have later on when I wrote my book based on 2011, because that time was 2002, and that comes right after the arduous march, which late 90s, millions of North Koreans died from the worst famine. So, which, you know, all the estimates about North Korea statistics are usually impossible to be, you know, you cannot verify any of them. So roughly, they say about a tenth of the population died from hunger. So when I went there in 2002, literally it was dark, you know, that their airport had no electricity and heat and you know, no toilet paper in the bathroom, even in the airport. And I remember at the VIP quarter, I went to sleep with a coat on, you know, and this was the VIP quarter. So you could really feel, you know, they also took me to Kim Jong-il-ia exhibition. Kim Jong-il-ia is a Kim Jong-il flower that's specifically engineered for the great leader. It kind of looks like, what is, you know that flower, the Christmas flower?
The poinsettia.
Poinsettia. Yeah, it looks just like poinsettia, because I guess it's kind of, there's always sort of equivalent to him being God figure. So they took me to the Kim Jong-il-ia exhibition, which is a building full of these little vendors or different organizations basically make decorations with the Kim Jong-il flower. Mm-hmm. And I was shown that for maybe 4 hours, you know, every single booth they take you and basically show you how amazing the great leader is and how beautiful these flowers are. It was freezing, I remember, that because there's just no electricity. And in February is his birthday. And it's really cold in Pyongyang.
I can understand why the cold would distract you, the environment would distract you. But you must have been fascinated by this worship of the great leader, that everybody was doing it, right? They had to do it. And it was all they knew.
It was all. I think that first time, though, I think what struck me very vividly was the absolute lack of everything. You know, there's no car on the street. There's just no heat and no light. But I think
And yet they're talking about worshiping the great leader. With all this deprivation, they still are, making flower arrangements in his honor, right?
Right. That utterly fanatic way that they worship their great leader was very striking. I think I remember just crying a lot, because that amount of control to be in a place like that when you don't believe in the great leader, which obviously I don't. And I just felt like, what does this mean about these people? How do they live on a daily basis? What does it mean about the humanity of North Korea? And I couldn't penetrate that, obviously, on that first trip, which is obviously why I kept returning. But I think I really wept every night I was there. I was there that first time about 8-9 days, and I just wept because I kept thinking, this amount of control, you know, minder led every single step, means something is, you know, entire nation is being controlled. And what does that mean for this to have gone on for the last 60 years? Who died here, basically?
Right. So it sounds like you became more obsessed and interested in North Korea, and led to more trips, and then the trip that we'll talk about during this hour of the show that your book is based on in 2011 when you became a teacher at that university. So we'll take a break here and come back and talk some more with Suki Kim, who's spending a little time with us this hour ahead of her speaking engagement tonight at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I'll tell you about that as well. Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite, a memoir by Suki Kim, our guest, is published by Crown Books. 410-662-8780 is the number for midday. If you have a question for our guest, Suki Kim, a short break. We'll be right back. Some of what Suki Kim wrote about Pyongyang. For a place shrouded in rumors of violence, Pyongyang always appears surprisingly gentle, at least at first. And you also say, the silence is strange, since wherever else you are in Pyongyang, your senses are never left at peace. Inevitably, music blasts from a speaker nearby. Sometimes it is a love song, sometimes a marching tune, but the topic is always the same. Virtually every building is adorned with a slogan. Every TV screen with the same image, the way advertising billboards fill the horizon in Western societies. But in North Korea, there is only one product, the great leader. Yet beneath such noise is terrifying silence. Everything has been so hushed for decades that if you press your ear to the stillness, you can almost hear the muted cries. That's from Suki Kim's writing. Her book is Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. So Suki, you wanted to go back again in 2011. This idea of becoming a teacher at a university, how did this come about?
I found out about it actually when I was in North Korea in 2008 to cover New York Philharmonic in Pyongyang. I covered that for Harper's Magazine. I did a long piece for that. And when I was there, someone actually told me about the school that was being set up. And, you know, it was very apparent to me by my second visit that there was no way I could write anything meaningful about North Korea unless I was embedded, because they only show you what's been staged. So if I were to just write down what I see there, which is all, you know, basically staged for my eye only, then I end up being North Korean regime's publicist as a writer, which I did not think was actually tolerable for me as a writer. So being embedded means trying to find a way of living there. And this seemed like a perfect opportunity. So I applied, and miraculously, I did get in to live there in 2011.
I meant to ask you this earlier, and it applies to this situation now. So you're going to go there and teach. Are you given instructions by someone who says, listen, you can do this and you can't do that. This is how you have to behave. This is how you have to dress. Did you get that kind of advice, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, haphazardly. It wasn't just like one meeting, you know, through over Skype sessions or with the school organizers who were basically, a lot of Americans, Korean Americans, and
who helped set up this university?
Right. It's a group of missionaries who they call themselves Christian educators, but they're really well-known missionaries in the region who'd already set up a parent school, a similar school in China since the 90s. So they are all Westerners, and they told me, because they were basically the founder of the school, they work with the North Korean regime. In cooperation with the North Korean regime, who knows exactly who they are. So it's sort of they sort of struck a deal together. So they told me what to do and what not to do, and that was an extensive list, as you can imagine.
I mentioned at the beginning of the show, blue jeans. You're not supposed to wear blue jeans because that's what, symbolic of the U.S., symbolic of the West?
America, which
America
is their enemy.
Specifically, right. And you never speak of the great leader in any other way besides the great leader?
Just don't speak about him.
Oh, don't speak about
yeah.
him. Okay. The school is the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, right?
Yes.
And you were going to teach English there.
Mm-hmm.
This is all male. And how old are the boys, the young men in the school?
Between the ages of 19 and 20.
Okay. So I just wish you'd take a moment here and tell us what that was first like for you, the first time you saw the students at the school and encountered them.
Well, the school is in a suburb of Pyongyang, and it's guarded by the military. And, it was a very small campus, and the students were a little like soldiers, you know, because they all work in a unit. They march to the cafeteria, and It was very sort of, at first struck me, of course, the first thing you realize is that you can't leave because the students are never allowed to leave, and teachers also are not, except on weekends with a minder group organized outings to a, you know, Westerner only kind of a market to get extra supplies. So at first it was that I had to, you know, and also to follow all the rules, because there were so many. And you realize that it was, you know, the fact that the military guards were always there, but also that everything is watched. Your classroom is reported on. Your meals, we did 3 meals a day with the students, which are me and 3 students, and they were all reporting on each other. You don't have a telephone, but you have an inter-campus phone only among teachers, you know, teacher dormitory. But those were tapped, and the minders lived on the ground floor, whose job is to watch you.
The minders.
Right.
Were these male or female?
They were male only. And also the school had a group of people.
Excuse me, I don't want to ask. So you have a minder, right?
Yeah.
What is your relationship with the minder?
Well, they are just there and they watch you. You know, they basically, you know, basically they, what their job is to note down what you're doing.
Do they know how you're supposed to teach?
Oh, that's a separate group called Counterparts. And that group of North Korean staff, we had to get every lesson plan approved. So those were different. They were like administrative minders. And these other minders were just to, you know, like an outing. You know, they are basically your guides.
A chaperone.
Chaperone, yes. Okay. They were our chaperone.
Okay. The boys, you say in the book that the students were always in pairs.
They're never alone with you,
never
ever.
Alone, okay.
And they're rarely never alone ever in the campus. But campus was very tiny, and they don't really do free activities on their own. You know, they're all in a group marching to different things, group duties, activities. They do things like guard the great. There's also a great leader building. It's a Kim Il-sung-ism building, which they study Juche, their foundation philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So they go there and study, and they had to also guard that building. It's a kind of like a shrine, if you can think of it. Like, it's their church, in a way, because that is their god.
You know, Suki Kim, I'm thinking about the situation you were in on this trip with a minder nearby and the, what was the other one, the
Counterparts.
The counterparts. I mean, I would feel like there was a spy around all the time, basically, and that I would be very frightened that I was going to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing or wear the wrong shirt or something. And I don't know what the consequence would be, but your experiment would be over. Maybe you couldn't be embedded like you wanted to be. They would send you out of the country. I don't know. But were you worried that you were going to slip up and just say the wrong thing?
Constantly.
Constantly.
I mean, it was
okay.
A constantly, yeah. That was on my mind. You always check what you're saying. There are 2 levels to this. I mean, a couple of levels. One, because I did have an ulterior motive. You know, I was writing a book. So if
but
I
they
were
didn't
caught,
know that.
They didn't know that.
Didn't
so if
know
I were
that.
Caught with that, I mean, that's, you know, that's not a light crime, really. I was, you know, writing notes down for a book which they didn't want. So there's that. Another thing is, if I say the wrong thing, would I be kicked out or would I be found out? Which could also then lead to, you know, who knows what punishments. But also I could get somebody else in trouble, meaning the students. And that was really hard.
When you took notes, this was by hand?
Or never.
Never by hand. So
never.
What did you do? A flash drive or something like that? What did you? How did you store your notes?
I did everything and put it on USB stick, which I kept on my body. And then I erased everything from the computer in case the computer was searched.
Right. Okay. And were you ever searched?
No, I was never searched. Okay. But I, you know, there was always a possibility. We were told that our computers will be searched. Probably, which didn't happen, but who knows?
But
you know,
who
when
knows?
I left it in the room.
Suki Kim, her memoir is Without You, There Is No Us. Suki, one of our listeners called in with a question for you. It's Paul in Baltimore. He said he's already read your book and has a question or a comment. Hello, Paul. Welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon, and hello, Miss Kim.
Hi.
Hello, hi.
I just finished your book actually about a week and a half ago. I heard about it actually on NPR a little while back, and I went out and got it. And I had a couple quick questions here. One of the most amazing images is of peasants just having random picnics on the roads. You wrote about that coming back on the bus from one of your weekend outings. You said that you thought that perhaps it was because they were looking for some sense of community, someplace, some sort of landmark, someplace where they could congregate. And with that lack of community that is prevalent in the North Korean country, do you think that they will ever be able to get enough groundswell support among themselves to move their political system to a more, I guess, fair system? You know, maybe not necessarily a democracy, but something else.
Well, you know, that's a fundamental question, really. What everybody is wondering in the rest of the world is that how long is this going to continue? The site that you're talking about, the scene you're talking about, is when we, the teachers, were led out on a group outing with a minder, and it's just empty. Pyongyang, there are not that many cars, but when you leave Pyongyang, the road remains just empty. And that's because you need a travel pass between each town. No one can really travel freely. So when I saw these random people, you might pass a little village, let's say, along the side of the highway, but there is nothing in between because, you know, there's no communication between towns. So these people, when they're sort of eating on the highway, literally sitting on the pavement because there are no cars, you can do that. But also, I did feel like it was a connection to the rest of the world somehow because they're so isolated. So how do you get people to organize some sort of grassroots movement? You know, people talk about North Korea, you know, Arab Spring, comparing it to that. But there is no internet there. And there is, you know, basically communication is blocked, which is how the government controls. So we don't, you know, the question is a good one. And that's what we are all asking. How are they going to rise against their government when there is no communication and you can't travel freely?
I wonder this sort of fundamental question about North Korean society, how it functions, what people do for a living, what kind of jobs people have. Do people get up in the morning and commute, you know, walk or take a bicycle to a factory? Do they make anything? Is there productivity? I know it doesn't look like our society, but this one particular aspect I wonder about. Is someone making food in a little carryout shop someplace? Is someone mending clothes or fixing shoes? Are people employed?
Well, you don't really, you know, one of the striking things when you are taken to a shop there, which is general, I mean, we were only taken to the foreigner shops, but, you know, we were also taken to a market where locals shopped. And you don't see anything that's made in North Korea. Maybe water? Bottled water, but clearly that's for foreigners because, you know, the regular people can't afford that. There was an apple snack, like a potato chip kind of base, you know. I'm talking really a handful.
Yeah.
You know, I have to really think to see what was made in North Korea.
But someone is working in this market, right? Trying to sell you something.
Right. So the market culture is increasing, black market culture especially, because the distribution system, which is their system, it's a socialist system, is not working because people are not getting their food.
Is there a factory anyplace that you noticed?
I didn't notice, but I mean, supposedly they do exist. So coal mining, you know, whatever it is. But we're just not seeing any sort of a productivity of any kind, which is a big problem.
This leads me back to your students at the PUST. Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. Now, you say in the subtitle of your book, you describe it as North Korea's elite. This is a privileged class of students there, all boys, all young men. Who are their parents? Are their fathers all in the military or the government?
Their fathers were, you know, the party officials, meaning the Workers' Party, or doctors or scientists. Those were generally, basically the party official would be the highest. But whatever their fathers were, they were in 2011, which was year Juche 100, because they count their calendar system according to the birth of the original great leader, Kim Il-sung. Juche year 100, they closed down every university in North Korea except Pust. So everybody, every university student in North Korea were put into construction fields to build a prosperous and powerful nation, which is a slogan they use. So if everybody else is in a construction field except these boys, I mean, they were creme de la creme because they were spared for some reason.
Mm-hmm. How did they take to learning English? Were they interested in learning English?
It's not really a system where they're interested or not interested.
They have to do it. Okay, we have to take another break. Before I do, though, I've been dying to ask you this question from your book, Lying. Your students lied, you say.
All the time.
They lied. They lied all the time about almost anything, the mundane and to things larger. What was that all about? Please talk about that. First, your observation that they lied. Give us examples. And then what are your thoughts on that?
Well, at first I started realizing they lied just randomly. You know, they would tell me like they cloned a rabbit in fifth grade. Or they would say, you know, they didn't... they would say, like, you know, if a student is missing and I'm supposed, you know, I shared a meal with them, and if one student is not there, they would immediately say he's sick or he's getting a haircut. You know, the answer came instantly when I would say, where is he? And then if I say, so which one? And they'll say, oh, went to her getting a haircut, but I got a stomachache. You know, like, so it was like very, very fluent, easy lies, kind of for no reason in a way. So it took me a while to realize why they were lying. And there were several tiers of lies, meaning sometimes they had to because they were protecting their system. You know, like instead of saying that they were, you know, allowed to relax, they had to do some great leader duties. But clearly they weren't supposed to talk about that. So they'll tell me they slept late, although I know they worked all morning. So protecting their system, sometimes there were taught lies, you know, like they were supposed to tell the world they cloned the rabbit in the fifth grade. But, you know, they didn't. So some of it is just being taught wrong information sometimes, or sometimes it was a habit. So I think that, you know, because so many lies were everywhere, sometimes they didn't know that it became a habit. So, you know, I have to say the lies, though, like once I realized why they were lying, it made me really feel for them. Because I don't know.
It makes
me
sad to think about that. Think the society is a lie.
Right. Like they are a beautiful age of 20. And they were lovely young men. You know, I adore them. I really love them from the bottom of my heart. And it kind of made me love them more. Because I felt like, what kind of world is this where you have this incredibly smart, they were brilliant, like bright, bright, bright young men. And that they were forced to lie to exist. You know, and I think that is a real sadness.
I think you described a scene where you went by a computer lab. You noticed in the computer lab these young men, boys and young men, are sitting in front of computers that aren't connected to anything. They're basically using the computers, you said, for definitions of words.
Looking up dictionaries because they weren't taught the internet. They didn't know the existence of the internet, and they were computer majors. So that scene of looking at them was so – and they were such bright kids – and I thought, why waste your youth like this? You know, that's what the country's doing. You're wasting their brightest mind by making them dumb, basically.
Suki Kim is with us in this hour, midday, to talk about her experiences in North Korea. Without You, There Is No Us is her memoir, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. Suki Kim will be at UMBC tonight, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, giving the Asian Studies lecture and book signing. It's at 7 p.m. in the Kuhn Library on the 7th floor out at UMBC. I'll repeat that before the end of the hour. If you have a question about North Korea and Suki Kim's experiences there, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance for the midday show at WYPR is 866-661-9309 and our email address midday@wypr.org. Suki Kim, Without You, There Is No Us. The title, Without You, There Is No Us, That comes from what? One of the great leaders' favorite slogans? Is that it?
It's a song that my students used to sing when they would march to the cafeteria. They often sang songs like that, but that one in particular I heard so often that, you know, I can still hum it. So familiar to me. But it means, yes, without you, the great leader, there is no us.
By the way, what was for lunch when they walked or marched to lunch? What did you eat in the university?
The food was fine, but I mean, not, you know, it's probably much better than anywhere else in North Korea, but still...
Well,
just the rice and vegetable,
rice?
Marinated vegetable, not fresh vegetable, and barely any meat, though, which was not, you know, because they're all growing boys. So, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was a bit dire by our standard, but for North Korea, it was fine.
Did you get to travel away from the university? Did you go into Pyongyang? Last year, we saw a documentary on Frontline. The PBS Frontline, that included video shot in North Korea of some very, dire poverty, children in the street looking for food, picking through trash, trying to find something to eat. There was a lot of that in that particular Frontline documentary. Did you get to see any of that?
Yeah, no, they don't show you that. I mean, those are the kind of things that, you know, even when they lead you out of the school on a group outings, it's all organized, carefully manipulated scenes. But I think that what I was able to glimpse is actually the psychology and the psychology of the elite, which is not something that I, you know, that we don't know what that is. You know, we have a lot of de facto testimonies of the utter poverty in North Korea. But the actual psychology, basically what it reveals is the control on an unimaginable level. And I think that then makes you wonder how does this, you know, makes you wonder what is going on in the rest of the country. And what I mean is actually mentally.
Suki Kim spent most of her time in this last trip to North Korea in 2011 at Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. And she's written a memoir based on her experiences there over a six-month period. Mike has read your book. Mike's in Annapolis, and he had a question for you, Suki Kim. Mike, go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks, Dan.
Sure.
And Ms. Kim, I just really appreciate your writing. I just want to say that I thought your book was a bone-chilling insight into how that entire population is controlled and contained. I can't recommend it highly enough. And also to hear you speak of your warmth for them, having come out of that experience, is really just so inspiring. Anyway, my question is this. It has to do with the organization that actually brought you in to teach. Because I know in your book you talk about the difficulty of trying to maintain a stand so that you had integrity with them and you were able to continue teaching. And I'm wondering what your relationship is now with that organization, and also if the revelations from your book have affected the school at all. And if you don't mind, I'll listen off the air. And again, thank you very much for writing this.
Thank you for your comment on the book. Yes, that's an important question. The organization that brought me, there's a couple of levels, because it's an undercover journalism is an uncomfortable one. You know, that I pretended to be one of them to get in there. But there is actually no way of covering North Korea. You know, it's the most corrupt nation that will not be investigated. Because people ask me, why did you lie? Why did you not ask for a permission? There is a reason there is no unfiltered portrait coming out of North Korea that is not by the defector testimony. Other than that, we don't have such a thing. Exactly for that reason. And for such a corrupt subject, you do actually have to pretend to be something you're not in order to be accepted by the community, which is how I got in there. Otherwise, they wouldn't have let me in. And so I can understand why they're unhappy personally with me. And I have been contacted by the school before the publication, tried to stop the publication. Very, very furious. Since the book came out, however, I've actually heard from several teachers, former teachers who no longer teach there, and who are very happy with the book. They were actually...
Excuse me, are they Americans?
They're different. You know, they're
different
all like, you know, they're New Zealand or Canada. Christian missionaries. But they're different levels, I think, basically. And people, I think some of them was misunderstood. I think people thought by me writing the book, I was outing this group. And these are people are going to all be sent to a gulag or something. No, these missionaries are very different from Kenneth Bay and Jeffrey Fowle, who were the grassroots missionaries who snuck in there and ended up getting, you know, they all got released, but they were sent to a, one of them was sent to a gulag. Those are different. The group of missionaries I was with who ran Pust are there in cooperation with the regime, who knows exactly what they're doing. The school is funding $35 million to set up that school, far more to run it. So the fundamental you know, churches around the world are funding the education of the elite of North Korea, which is all fine. You know, I think that's a, it's a problematic premise. But I wasn't there in order to cover the school or expose them. I was there to, in order to write about North Korea so we can do something to help the 25 million people who live in that nation. That's really a gulag posing as a nation. And as for the repercussion to school, I can understand probably, so, you know, the president probably was reprimanded and had to come up with more money. Or I cannot really guess what might have happened. But, you know, the fact that these are the most lawyer, really, they are working with the regime and really, you know, raise a lot of funds. So I don't really see what could have changed with the school. The school's fine, as far as I know. I was mostly concerned about repercussions for the students. And that haunted me. And I did everything possible to blur their identities. But most of all, so that you can't tell who's who.
Mm-hmm.
But most of all, they come across loyal to their regime in the
loyal.
Book. Right.
Yes,
so,
yeah.
I mean, what could possibly, you know, I protected them. So I'm fine on that aspect.
Suki, I want to ask you about this. I made a note here that you say in the book, when the minders are around and your counterparts are around observing you so much, you say eventually you felt like you lost your own sense of freedom, but you were surprised at how easy it was to sort of mindlessly obey, to get along.
You know, I think the experience of being there was really complicated on many levels. I didn't really, I couldn't tell the world to them, to my students who I really cared about. I wanted to, but if I told them, they could really get in trouble, and also they could also not be happy being stuck there. But also, I also didn't have any freedom to show them what freedom really is, because, you know, being abused, I think that's what I learned on another level, was it's kind of easy to end up being abused. And when you are, which is really, I think of North Koreans as an abused nation, population, by their government. So when you are living inside an abuse, it's very easy to become be stripped of power. And once you're stripped of power, and the power that controls you has all the power, there's nothing, anything you can do as an individual. You know, I think that's what I felt. And that utter powerlessness, because I didn't have any power either, was a frightening thing for people to be stuck like that, to live in that abuse for the rest of your lives.
When the boys, the young men, wrote essays for you, composition, what were they like? Because I can't imagine, if you grow up in that environment, you have any imagination. I just read a biography of Albert Einstein, who said he was all for freedom, 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 liberal thinking, liberal thought, because without it, there's no creativity. We can't imagine anything. So I wonder, What was the writing like? What was reflected in their writings?
I mean, I tried to teach essay writing, which is something I introduced. You know, it was not a part of the curriculum. And I did get that approved by counterparts, me insisting that this was necessary. But then, you know, once I started teaching essay writing, I realized it was impossible, because essays are all about coming up with your assertion and proving it. Proving is a very big part of essay writing. And there was no such a thing. They don't prove and they don't come up with an assertion.
It requires critical thinking.
Critical thinking is not allowed there, basically. And that was really a struggle to try to teach, and finding it impossible, and realizing, you know, also because they were really smart. You know, if these were not so lovely and bright kids, But they were so smart in once. So that's what was so complicated. That's why I think, you know, the whole point of writing the book was to humanize North Korea. And humanity is complicated. And, you know, youth being 20 is complicated. But critical thinking was not allowed because they weren't supposed to think. And I think that was the greatest tragedy about my experience there, learning what North Korea really is.
You must have felt an urge at times to say, boys, young men, you can live better than this. Or I guess if there was such an urge, you had to repress it.
You know, so, I mean, it came in moments when I would lose myself or slip up or, you know, but there was, you know, we could only discuss what was in the book, you know, the ESL book that I had to use that was approved. Mm-hmm. And one time, for example, television was a topic. And I did, you know, they don't ever ask voluntarily, but because this was about television, lesson on television, which they only have one channel, which only plays news about the great leader. So they did say, so what about, how many channels do you have? You know, they felt comfortable with me enough to ask that. And I did say hundreds of television channel. I couldn't go on about how a lot of TV channels are junk. You know, I didn't talk about that, but I did say over and over, hundreds of channels. And I realized I would say, we have a choice of hundreds of channels. And that was my way of saying, boys, you know, outside, we have such thing as a choice. You know, so it was not about hundreds of channels. It's about having a choice of hundreds of channels.
Mm-hmm.
And I repeated that, I remember, at meals, thinking, I hope you get this message. You know, it was all like a doublespeak in a way.
Yeah. But do you think they got what you were saying? Do you think
If they did, they didn't show it. And I would assume they did. Some of them did see what that was. But I don't know what one does that with that knowledge also, you know?
An interesting email from one of our listeners, David in Towson. He says, I took my son to a space science lecture at the Johns Hopkins Space Telescope Institute. The astrophysicist showed photos of Earth from space at night. He pointed out the very bright concentration of lights that indicated cities. The very dark areas next to the bright lights were shown to be ocean or water, where lights could not exist. The scientist then showed an area with very bright lights and an absolute straight line with extreme darkness above the line. He then showed a photo of the same region in daylight, and the audience gasped to observe that we were seeing the contrast between developed South Korea and completely undeveloped North Korea above the line. This was a truly shocking visual demonstration of the extreme deprivation of North Korea. So I thought I'd share that with you. On a last note here, we're down to the last couple minutes, Suki. Brian wanted to know if there is romance in North Korea. How do people get married? How do they fall in love?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the boys all pretended they never thought about girls because they only served their great leader. By the end, though, you know, they were talking about their girlfriends at home, whom they're not allowed to be in touch with while they're at the school. So certainly there is romance.
But they were at least talking about them.
Yeah, I mean, they're like boys like us, you know? I think that's what was so sad about the whole thing.
Yeah. Thank you, Suki.
Thank you.
It was nice to have you on the show. Nice to meet you. Suki Kim, with her memoir, Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite, published by Crown. Now, Suki Kim will be out at UMBC tonight at 7 p.m. for a lecture and book signing sponsored by the Asian Studies Department out there. She'll be in the Albert Kuhn Library on the 7th floor at 7 p.m. if you'd like to meet her and get a copy of her book. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody. I hope you enjoyed today's Midday, and we'll come back again tomorrow. Dan Rodericks for our staff here. Have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Marjorie Goodman, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.